Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Wednesday, March 20th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. We tackle the tough topics involving media performance from the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism. I'm Mike McKean, director of the RJI Futures Lab. Our panelists are J-School colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. You may have read that Charles will soon become the journalism dean at his hometown school and SEC rival, the University of Georgia. So, Charles, can we boo you and congratulate you at the same time?
Yes, you may. Much like I have been having tears of joy and tears of sadness. Yeah.
Well, we're going to go on with our program today as if none of that happened. You're still going to opine on the topics, which are the annual State of the News Media Study, which came out from the Pew Research Center this past week. It paints a depressing picture of less reporting and more opining. But there are some who say we're actually in the glory days of journalism. So we'll talk about that. CNN is taken to task for allegedly sympathizing with the Steubenville High School football stars convicted of raping a 16-year-old. The UK press gets tougher regulations than it bargained for in the wake of the phone hacking scandal. Critics say the news media are hanging WikiLeaks whistleblower Bradley Manning out to dry, and a couple of questionable photos, including one of a Mizzou student, raise familiar ethical issues. Well, let's begin with the report released this week from the Pew Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism. Each year, they issue a report on the state of the news media based on surveys and content analysis of American news organizations. Needless to say, it's a dense and detailed study that we're only going to skim over. If you'd like to see the whole thing, of course, there is a link on our blog. But here are a few of the findings. Newspapers and television newsrooms have far fewer people reporting stories than they did a decade ago. MSNBC and Fox News Channel spend far more airtime opining about the news than actually reporting it. CNN is the only one of the big cable news outlets to produce more straight journalism than commentary, and just a little more. By far, the worst offender is MSNBC, with 85% of its airtime given to opinion, only 15% to actual reporting. Well, there are several other findings that we'll talk about in a minute, but Lee, let's start with that one, the fact that basically far less reporting, far more opining. What do you think of that?
There is not much to think. One of the things that I like about Pew, I mean, there are lots of things that they do that I don't like because I think that they just do snapshots. But every once in a while, they do a snapshot that has some real meaning. And I think this is one of them. For people who actually watch television news, read newspapers or read magazines or even listen to this show upon occasion, none of this is, quote, news. I think what is news is that the audience is noticing. And that's sort of the other part of the Pew study that I think is very important.
And we'll talk about that a bit more in just a minute. But Charles, I mean, it is obvious if you've been watching that there's far less real reporting going on. And especially in television news, I mean, we see all of the sort of visual tricks. Like, let's do a lot of interviews with the experts and the pontificators. Let's do a lot of live stand-ups, but not a lot of packaged journalism where you have to actually do the digging and the reporting.
One of the great frustrations of the Pew Report, which I'm still wading through, is that they don't really hit at a point you just made, Mike, and that is that there's this amazing difference between broadcast, particularly cable television news, and print news, which there are less reporters in print news per capita. Absolutely. There are fewer boots on the ground. But those boots that are still on the ground are doing reporting, whereas broadcast cable television, interestingly enough, have not really reduced the boots on the ground. They have reduced the reporting that those boots are doing. And I wish that Pew kind of went into greater detail on that issue, because I think that is really the threshold issue of the problem. Television news is just – changing at the national level into pontification.
It's also changing at the local level. And one of the things that Pew found was that finally, I guess you could say, that the pain that newspapers have been feeling for some time now, eroding audiences, declining revenues, that local TV, if you don't count those folks who are in swing states where there was $1 bazillion in political advertising being spent, they're suffering too, Lee.
Well, they're suffering too. And one of the other things in that report, and again, if you watch yourself watch local television news, you already know this, is that something like 40% of local television news is devoted to either sports or the weather or just a tiny, tiny amount of news at that first little part of the news half hour, the news hour, or, you know, or whatever it is. That's a lot of time taken up with things that are predictable, either audience-centric, that would be the weather, or big revenue producers, that would be sports. So it's a place where the economics of the business, and this is another thing that Pew doesn't really talk about very much, where the economics of the business have dictated content, not in the sense that they've come and said, you will cover this story and not that story, but in the sense of how the news whole itself is allocated.
Well, and as you suggested, the Pew study also shows that this sort of downplaying of real news is hurting news organizations in ways that we can now measure. For example, they say that 3 in 10 Americans that they surveyed this past year say they've abandoned a news outlet that they used to count on because it no longer provides them with the news that they're accustomed to getting. That's pretty sobering.
Yeah, the stuff in the Pew report on the, I would call it the death spiral of journalistic outlets, where the news hole gets cut, reporting resources get cut. It reaches the point where the consumer feels it, sees it, and then says, why would I pay money for this product? It's not informing me anymore, and then walks away. And it becomes this real chicken and egg question, which is how much can you cut until you've cut too much? And I think a lot of American news institutions have reached the point of bone marrow cutting. And it's, you're right, consumers are beginning to figure it out.
Now, there is a sort of a contrarian take that we've posted on our blog that I find kind of interesting as writer Matthew Iglesias over at Slate. And he said that in his reaction to this latest study that the Pew researchers are conflating the state of the traditional news media with the state of journalism. In fact, he argues that as far as the public is concerned, at least, we're in the glory days of American journalism. Lee, we've got access to many more credible sources of news, more background, more context, and all of it's being delivered to us more easily through our digital devices. So what do you make of that opinion?
Well, we may be in the glory days of American journalism, but what we are not in is the glory days of an audience for American journalism. Americans particularly are more pressured. They're busier. They've made some judgments, and whether I like those judgments or not, those are judgments. Those are real-world judgments. So we can have a huge amount of stuff out there. The amount of it that it's being read and by whom is a question that I don't think the Slate columnist addresses, and I don't think the Pew Report addresses either.
I don't necessarily disagree with that, but Charles, I do think there is something to be said for the fact that there is a proliferation of news content that's available to us, and until some of these big news organizations crash and burn, the public really doesn't have any reason to be all that worried about it.
You know, it's funny. I've sort of lived through this to some extent this week with the announcement of the deanship at Georgia. I watched carefully what was reported. I had one reporter interview me. She was a reporter from the Columbia Museum. She did a great job. Way to go, Katie. And it was a great interview. That story ran. Every other piece of content about me becoming the dean of Georgia was recirculated press release.
Right.
And that ran in 40 or 50 different places. Therein lies the problem. Not, and this is the problem with Matthew's thesis.
Right.
There's content aplenty. Yes, no one argues there's content aplenty. But if you Google up me and Dean and Grady College, what you will find is the same content over and over and over and over. If you apply that to courts and police and economics, you see the problem.
Well, let's turn to a story that had plenty of different news outlets reporting on it, and one of them getting in a little bit of trouble for the way they handled it. Last Sunday, the juvenile judge hearing the case of those two Steubenville, Ohio football stars that were accused of raping a 16-year-old girl, the judge found them guilty. The case had sparked outrage, as you know, around the country, led to questions about whether the town's football culture had led to an attempted cover-up. The suspects even shared images of their behavior on social media, which kind of ironically may have been their undoing. Well, CNN broke the news during Candy Crowley's State of the Union program on Sunday. Reporter Poppy Harlow really stepped on a landmine when Crowley asked her about the emotions in the courtroom.
I've never experienced anything like it, Candy. It was incredibly emotional, incredibly difficult even for an outsider like me to watch what happened as these two young men that had such promising futures, star football players, very good students, literally watched as they believed their life fell apart. One of the young men, Malik Richmond, when that sentence came down, he collapsed. He collapsed in the arms of his attorney, Walter Madison. He said to him, "My life is over. No one is going to want me now."
For the next 5 minutes, Harlow, Crowley, and a CNN legal analyst talked in detail about the impact of the verdict on the football players, not a word until much later about the victim. Well, critics pounced. Why was CNN seemingly showing sympathy for the teenage rapist and not the 16-year-old girl who was assaulted and photographed? Well, Lee, is that fair criticism?
I think it's fair criticism, and yet I also understand one of the things that journalists get to do that's really awful is we get to watch young people who are not yet 18 or 21, occasionally reap the rewards of exceptionally bad behavior on their own parts or on somebody else's. And if you have an ounce of humanity in you, even though what they've done is horrible and horrifying, you have to go, 16 years old, that's a terrible, terrible part of your life to literally just throw away. Assuming that all of that is true, assuming that journalists are human beings and that one of the things we're supposed to do well is connect with other human beings, I don't know where our brains were. I don't know whether we thought that we were protecting the young woman's privacy by not mentioning her. I don't know what happened, but someone should have thought this through just a little bit better, and maybe not with that initial stand-up, but certainly at the end of 5 minutes, we should have gotten somewhere with it.
I just wonder, Charles, if this isn't a function of something we talk about TV news all the time, that TV news is process journalism, and nobody could say that CNN, over the many days they've covered this trial, didn't talk about the impact of rape on the young woman, talked about her family, talked about the social media, all that other stuff. But during the immediate minutes right after the verdict, it seemed like they were a little tin-eared. There was no balance in that one individual report.
Well, and I think this is the state of modern media criticism, in which you can take a small piece of content out of the overall content and then use it to harangue the reporters who were engaged in that commentary. Now, watching that in splendid isolation, it's infuriating. Mm-hmm. But you're right. I watched actually a lot more of it. I just happened to be watching CNN then, and I watched a lot of it. And before that segment, or maybe just after it, I can't remember which, but they had the father of one of the convicted rapists on, and he talked about the fact that he was partially responsible because he was an absentee father. And I got to tell you, it was some of the most moving, gripping television I have seen lately. I stood slack-jawed watching him speak. It was just incredibly moving. Yeah. I don't see any praise for that work. I also don't see any praise for a package later in the day on just what you said, the sort of victimology and how often these horrific crimes are taking place and whether alcohol doesn't fuel a lot of this among teens. Yeah. CNN did all of that and should be commended for it. But you can always pull out the minute that you want to attack them for.
The other thing that's going on here, and I'm putting two seemingly unrelated stories together that are very related to me. So we have this story, and then we have last week's congressional hearings about the incidents of rape of both genders in the U.S. military. Mm-hmm. Those are dots that it's incumbent upon us as journalists to connect. Yes, one occurs with a 16-year-old, the other occurs in the U.S. military, but it says something horrid about the larger culture that we live in. And so when you say process journalism, Mike, you're right. But the other thing we're really bad at is saying, you know, these are two stories that really are about the same phenomenon. Why are we not digging in on that?
And Charles, I will agree with everything you've said about CNN's overall coverage, and there's some things that they should be lauded for. But I do wonder, to get to Lee's point, if CNN and many other media covering this story are at least in some ways as guilty as the town that they were covering about glorifying and protecting high school athletes from the consequences of this kind of behavior.
And clearly that was a moment. I'm not defending that one moment. I mean, there was a moment when a producer, this is why producers in newscasts are doing their jobs, I thought. Somebody should have been in somebody's earpiece saying, make sure you talk about the victim when we come back from this interview. This is incredibly one-sided. And it was. And the criticism is valid. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying that it has much to do with digital technology, that you can make a YouTube video in which you pull out anything, pull that minute out, and it looks terrible in isolation. It looks less terrible, I think, in total.
I think, too, though, Lee, that part of this is just the function of what TV news is good at, what it focuses on, which is looking for an emotional hook, and that by all means there has to be something visual. So the boys did break down on camera in court. We can't see any pictures of the victim, although we did name her later. But so it's you've really got to make a conscious effort to override those sensibilities.
You do. But I thought that's what we went to journalism school to learn how to do. And it certainly is what all three of us are trying to teach our students how to do. We realize that the medium itself exerts some pressure. There are ways to resist that.
Well, speaking of the social media, clearly we said they played a role not only in the horrible behavior of the boys, taking these pictures and sharing them on YouTube and other places, texting about it. But it also helped to expose the case without the efforts of a blogger named Alexandria Goddard. And without this hacker group Anonymous, this trial might not have ever happened. So what does that say about the impact of social media versus traditional media on stories like this?
It's absolutely fascinating to think about the fact. And I think you're quite right to say, who knows if this goes to trial without the shenanigans on social media in which they literally convicted themselves. It also, of course, was introduced as voluminous evidence at trial, which became equally fascinating, I think.
What it shows is that my mother was right. My mother always told me you should never do anything or say anything that you don't want to have on the front page of the newspaper. So all she would have to add now is that you don't want to see on YouTube or that you don't want to see tweeted. And I think it would work pretty well.
And Lee, could you say just a little bit before we leave this particular story about the decision the next day? CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, they all aired a clip from one of the defendants who named the victim as part of his apology. Now, if that happened live, you could understand if they were asleep at the switch, but they replayed that. So they've named the victim. Is that violating our standard ethics of journalism?
I think it's violating the standard ethics of journalism. I'm making an assumption that they did not have the victim's permission to do so. And since the victim is a minor, they would also have needed the young woman's parents. I don't know what we were thinking. I mean, it was possible to bleep that.
Oh, easily. Easily. I mean, it's error compounded by error.
And in fact, Fox News for a while was also not giving the names of the defendants, arguing that they were juveniles, too. And that leads to a whole long argument we could have about that, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is the issue is if they were tried as adults, rape to me in my own stereotypical thinking is a pretty adult crime.
Well, let's talk about some more bad press behavior, specifically the phone hacking scandal that involved one of News Corp's London newspapers. As we know, that led late last year to calls for a more robust and independent press regulator. The British media promised that they would help establish such an office. At the time, Prime Minister David Cameron opposed plans by some in Parliament to actually write this new press restriction into law. Well, in the wee hours of Monday morning, Charles Cameron's Conservative Party joined the Liberal Democrats, the Labour Party, a victims' rights group, and they hammered out a deal that would get the government involved. Publishers who didn't apologize properly when accused of spreading false information, or those who refused to take part in the new oversight body itself, could be subject to really big fines. Well, the media representatives, as we all know, were not invited to this late night negotiation session, and most, although not all of them, found fault with the outcome. Well, you're our media law specialist. Do you find fault with the outcome? What does this signify about the state of British press and the public?
It's in dire danger, and I could not be more opposed. I mean, you typified it really well. It was a late night, closed door, secret negotiation, from what I've been able to read, that produced. It's not exactly media law, it's media regulation. It's a regime of fines levied upon people who don't comply with a regulatory system that they haven't built yet, which is really interesting. The regulatory system's not built yet, but the fine system is. So what they're saying basically is, we now have the club raised over your head. We will now go about the business of building whatever it is that you must comply with, lest we club you.
Well, you know, Lee, before England had something called the Press Complaints Commission, anathema to American journalists already, and clearly that was a body that lost whatever credibility it ever had with the British people. But let's assume that Parliament ratifies this new deal, as Charles described it. Will that mean that the British press law is moving even farther away from our own laws governing and free speech?
Well, if you say law equals regulation, then I would have to say that it is, although not for obvious reasons. I mean, what we've got protecting us are two things. A, we've got this thing called the First Amendment. Thank you, founders. And B, we've got a litigious culture. So we'll sue anybody about almost anything. And the result is that we have a huge body of litigation about the First Amendment that does a wonderful job, by and large, of protecting journalists, even when we have bad judgments, we make mistakes of fact, you know, and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. The British don't have that. They don't have that litigious culture. And so I think, yes, we are on opposite sides of the pond, and we're going to be even further apart.
Well, there is an angle on our side of the pond, because News Corp is headquartered in the U.S. As we've described for a while, the Justice Department has been investigating possible violations of American laws since that phone hacking scandal broke. Well, according to a detailed article last Sunday in the Wall Street Journal, which is owned by News Corp, the investigation is winding down. The Justice Department may tell the company what, if any, penalties are going to have to pay. Settlement talks may start soon. But what I found most interesting, Charles, was in the story the fact that it appears that some informant came forward to the Justice Department and accused the Wall Street Journal of bribing Chinese officials to get information from stories from that country. So what do you make of that?
The story just gets stranger by the day. I've been following it with a great deal of interest, and it's just one of those where it feels like we don't know yet. Whether there's going to be another shoe drop in that episode, I have the feeling there will be.
Well, you know, the journal says it found no evidence of bribery. And under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, apparently companies have to do a lot of their own investigating of whether or not they violated the law. Mm-hmm. And they say the timing of this whole thing, Lee, suggests a Chinese agent who might have been angry with the paper's reporting on what's going on in the Communist Party in China. And it is interesting because it ties back to these stories we've been talking about the past few weeks of the Journal, the New York Times, and others who've been hacked by Chinese hackers.
How China comes out in all of this is, I think, really interesting. One of the things that at least I didn't see discussed in the journal is that there is this culture of what in China is called red envelope journalism, which is, I give you money, you write my story, I give you money, you keep my name out of the paper. Or if I'm the Chinese Communist Party, I will essentially get you fired or shut you down or do or make access impossible and a lot of other things. So in the middle of all of this, we have a very American set of social and legal mores that are being put on top of a culture that doesn't work quite that way. Even the New York Times, in its code of ethics, talks about when and where, upon very rare occasions, it will extremely rarely pay the bribe.
Well, let's talk about a couple of op-ed pieces that appeared this past week, including one in the New York Times. And they regarded the fate of Private Bradley Manning. For most of our listeners, you already know he's the soldier who gave hundreds of thousands of classified American documents to WikiLeaks, which in turn gave them to big media outlets like The Times and The Guardian. Well, Manning recently pleaded guilty to several charges before a military tribunal. He could end up serving 20 years in prison for those charges, but prosecutors are still intending to try him on a more serious charge of aiding the enemy. And if he's convicted of that, he could face life in prison. So, Lee, one of these op-ed pieces was from a First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams and a Harvard law professor, and they write under the headline, Death to Whistleblowers, and as the title suggests, of course, they're concerned that Manning's conviction could have like the ultimate chilling effect on people who help the media uncover government wrongdoing.
I buy about half of that. What they don't make a big point of, or at least as I read it, they didn't make a big enough point of, is that this is military justice. And I've heard people argue with some convincing that military justice is an oxymoron. And so Manning isn't just subject to civil law. He was a member of the U.S. Armed Forces when he did this. And hence, there's that set of laws and ways of doing things that compound this. The piece that I liked the best was by Ed Wasserman, and you posted it on the blog too. Ed is the dean at Berkeley, and he basically says, yes, of course this is going to have a chilling effect. And considering everything else the Obama administration has done about whistleblowing and whistleblowers, I actually think the weight of evidence supports that point of view.
Well, and Charles Wasserman not only was saying that, you know, the government is going after whistleblowers like this, but the headline of his piece was basically saying that the media have thrown him under the bus or have abandoned Manning. And from his point of view, at least, he's saying that Manning is the hero and traditional journalists are the cowards in this scenario.
I feel very uneasy with how Bradley Manning – I mean, I think abandonment is not too strong of a term, and I'm very uneasy with the lack of consistent, outraged media attention to, first of all, his case, but even more importantly, his physical treatment by the United States of America. This is a guy who is, as I read it, nude in solitary confinement 24 hours a day. That's depraved. And I as an American citizen, am outraged. I would think that my news media would be outraged and would cast a prolonged glare at his treatment, first of all. And then secondly, as to the case itself, I think Ed Wasserman is largely correct, but it's noteworthy. The New York Times columnists were two people who disagree fundamentally right. on the Manning legal situation, but agree completely that it's undermining rights for whistleblowers in every aspect of the federal bureaucracy. And that's worth noting.
Well, let's wrap up today's show with a couple more prosaic ethical issues, Lee. These revolve around the use or misuse of photographs. The first is the full front page photo from the New York Post that ran last week after the so-called cannibal cop was convicted of threatening to kill, torture, and eat women. You can see the picture if you watch our webcast. Officer Gilberto Valle is shown in a chef's jacket stirring a big pot with a ladle. The headline says, "Chopped liver, cannibal cop guilty." Well, Lee, anybody with half a brain could see this was photoshopped, and they do acknowledge it, but in really teeny tiny print running inside the photo. Is that adequate disclosure?
It's not adequate disclosure. On the other hand, it's the New York Post, which in my view ought to come in a plain brown wrapper, which would alert everybody that it's not what you think it is.
Well, and Charles, the second issue comes to us from Webster University in St. Louis. As the Riverfront Times reported last week, Webster uses a picture of a current Mizzou graduate student in journalism to promote its MBA program. This is on an ad that was displayed in Lambert St. Louis Airport. Problem is, Khalud Aid didn't enroll in the Webster MBA program, and she didn't think she'd given the school permission to use her image in the ads. But in fact, she had when she signed a waiver at an event she attended while she was an undergraduate at Webster. Is this any more or less an ethical lapse than the cannibal cop picture?
You know, it's funny. We talk about news gathering in the news sense. It's also very important in the advertising and public relations sense. Why not go get a current member of your student body to illustrate rather than being lazy?
Well, and Aid supposed, and I think she's probably right, Webster was looking for a, quote, ethnically ambiguous student as the face of their campaign.
Well, and brickbats at Webster – previous brickbats at the University of Wisconsin that photoshopped the ethnicity of its students in a lot of its promotional material. It's not that hard to just tell the truth. It really isn't.
I do wonder that if she were not a journalism student who had interned at the Riverfront Times, if we'd ever have even heard about this deception. Webster did, however, as a result of all the publicity, a lot of national publicity even, finally did remove the ad and promised they were going to use a student who really is in the MBA program to promote the MBA program. Well, that's our time for today. I want to thank Charles Davis and Lee Wilkins, of course, for their reflections as always. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan and KBIA's Pat Akers. They produce our program each week. And thanks to you for listening and watching. We have more information, including audio and video and news stories, available on our Links blog. It's under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. You can leave us a comment, a question, a topic suggestion there if you'd like, or if you'd prefer, you can do it by email at views@kbia.org. I'm Mike McKean. We're going to be off next week, so join Charles Lee and me on Wednesday, April 3rd, for the next edition of KBIA's Views of the News.